Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor, and Ben has left me all alone in the studio to be anxious by myself on debate day. Actually, there's lots of great people in the studio. You can't see them because they're not on this little camera right now. But don't worry. Ben's taken a week off, a much-deserved break. But we have an amazing show for you today, thanks to the magic of Zoom. It's going to be two parts. So I just talked with my former colleague, Colin Call. He was Biden's national security advisor when Biden was the vice president. Then Colin served as a top Pentagon official until last year. We tick through some of the biggest security challenges around the globe, from Iraq to Ukraine, Afghanistan, especially Republican efforts to pin everything bad that happened in Afghanistan on Vice President Harris now. We also talked about the growing security threat from Islamic extremist groups in Northern Africa. Then we talked about Bibi Netanyahu's arguments about what he needs to defeat ISIS and whether he really needs control of an area called the Philadelphia Corridor, which is that border region between Gaza and Egypt. So fascinating conversation with a real, real defense policy expert who was in a lot of the meetings about Ukraine, about Iraq, about Afghanistan, where the decisions we're now debating were made. And then you will hear my conversation with a truly excellent reporter named Vera Bergengruen. She recently interviewed two of the most bizarre, fascinating, and in some cases, very popular leaders in Latin America, Javier Milei in Argentina and Nayib Bukele in El Salvador. We talk about those guys, what it was like to interview them, how their, you know, sort of policies are going, why they're so popular, and then just the rise of right-wing populism generally. And we also talked about Russian propaganda efforts in the U.S. and their attempts to pay off some of the lamest right-wing influencers in the United States for, you know, propaganda reasons. So an excellent show. We cover a ton of ground. We cover a lot of topics that we don't always get to here on Pod Save the World, like Iraq. I think you're going to really love it. So without further ado, here's the interview with Colin. I am thrilled to welcome to the show my former colleague and one of the smartest, most experienced foreign policy minds I know, Colin Call. Great to see you.
It's great to be with you.
So this is a very fun today because you have this particular expertise in defense policy, because most recently you served as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the Biden administration. That's, you know, a top job at the Pentagon, but also the person that is at like every single National Security Council meeting, whether you want to be there or not, where all the big decisions are made. You left the Pentagon in 2023. And then before that, from I think 2014 to 2017, Colin served as Vice President, then Vice President Joe Biden's National Security Advisor. So again, in the PDB every day as part of all these big decisions. So you've done lots of other interesting stuff. I'm going to stop puffing you up now. And you're currently a senior fellow at Stanford University. I imagine you see our old colleague Mike McFaul an awful lot.
All the time. In fact, he's technically my boss, although don't tell him that because then he might start ordering me around.
He might start yelling at you. But listen, I'm so excited you're here. We were chatting earlier, both of us, or at least I'll speak for myself. I'm so anxious I can barely see straight because the debate is happening tonight. But also, there's a lot of issues we don't talk about on this show enough, starting with Iraq, our lean topic. And you literally were, you know, meeting with senior Pentagon leaders about these security challenges. You were traveling to places like Baghdad to meet the foreign governments, which is really great to have you. So again, starting with Iraq, which we haven't talked about for a while, but a couple stories caught my eye recently. The first was this major military operation last week by, I believe, the U.S. and Iraqi military targeting some senior ISIS leaders. And the second was a report in Reuters that said the U.S. and Iraq have reached a deal to withdraw U.S. troops from Iraq starting in 2025 and have all U.S. troops out by the end of 2026. However, this story noted that the two parties could cut a deal to keep U.S. troops in Iraq longer on some sort of advisory basis. And so, you know, Colin, these two stories together made me a little anxious because clearly there must be a pretty significant ISIS threat if it necessitated this big military operation. And that combined with the story about the withdrawal deadline made me think about 2010, when President Obama pulled all U.S. troops out of Iraq only to send them back in 2014 to deal with ISIS. So big picture, what is your view of the threat from ISIS in Iraq now? And what's your sense of the capacity of the security forces in Iraq and the government to handle it and the odds that U.S. troops are really out of the country by 2026?
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah, spent a lot of time in Iraq. I think between 2006 and 2016, I had about 20 trips to Iraq, about 4.5 months on the ground. So look, I think the answer is that ISIS is down, but not out. And, you know, your listeners will recall that, you know, ISIS, the last two letters stand for Iraq and Syria. So this is really a threat that crosses the Iraq-Syria border. So this raid that you mentioned recently that involved U.S. special forces, a large number of them, like 100, which is much larger than normal, with their Iraqi counterparts, was in western Iraq in Anbar province, where it was like the hotbed of the Sunni insurgency, you know, during the U.S. Occupation and counterinsurgency campaign there. But it really, ISIS not only has, you know, safe haven in parts of Anbar, but also in the mid-Euphrates River Valley in Syria. So we kind of work with different forces in the two countries. So in Iraq, we work with the Iraqi security forces and their counterterrorism forces. In Syria, we obviously don't work with the Assad government. We work instead with a coalition of Kurds and Arabs that we call the you know, Syrian Democratic Forces, the SDF. And the reality is that ISIS is still there. By CENTCOM statistics, their attacks are up this year. I don't think they are an existential threat to Iraq and Syria in the way that they were, say, you know, 10 years ago. Nor do I think that they are, you know, a clear and present danger every single day to the U.S. homeland. But the threat is still there, which begs the question then, like, why would we be talking about leaving if there's still the threat there? And there, I think you kind of have to zoom out and your listeners will understand the broader context, which is, you know, most of what we've been focused on in the Middle East, obviously since October 7th, has been the war in Gaza, but also just the broader back and forth with Iran and its various proxy groups in the region, you know, the Houthis in Yemen. They've got Shia militia groups in Syria, but also Shia militia groups in Iraq. And they have engaged in a bunch of attacks against U.S. forces over the years. And we have retaliated with strikes of our own. And when we have done that in Iraq, it's very controversial. It was controversial, obviously, when Donald Trump authorized the killing of Qasem Soleimani, you know, the Quds Force commander in Iraq back in 2020. But when we've done things in the Biden administration in Iraq, it's also been very politically sensitive. So there's a lot of political pressure on the prime minister in Iraq, Sudani, by, you know, domestic political pressure by Shia groups, but also by Iran to get the Americans out. And so really what I think the way to best understand the news is that they're trying to finesse a way out of this problem and that they're trying to create a time horizon that makes it look like we're leaving, but I would be doubtful that we totally leave. I think basically by the fall of 2025, I think we will have withdrawn, you know, several hundred troops. There are about 2,500 American troops in Iraq, another 900 in Syria. Several hundred of them will have departed. I think a lot of our presence will have consolidated into the north, into Erbil, in the kind of quasi-autonomous Kurdish area of Iraq. And that by the end of 26, my guess is we will still have, you know, hundreds of folks there, mostly in the north, some in Baghdad. They may be rebranded as advisors, but I mean, they're basically advisors now. So some of this will be, I think, really about managing Iraqi politics. I do not think that most of the Iraqi leadership wants to completely kick us out.
Yeah. Do you think they feel burned by the 2010, 2014 experience in the way I think a lot of Americans do?
So I think, yeah, burn may not be the right, you know, because look, Nouri al-Maliki, who was the prime minister back in 2011, he, you know, he would have maybe cut a deal to have us stay, but he was under a lot of pressure to get us out too. Yeah. And they thought they were ready. And clearly when ISIS swept over large portions of Iraq in 2014, they proved they weren't ready. I think the Iraqi security forces are in a better place and they probably can keep a lid on ISIS with a, you know, a smaller, more manageable number of American forces. I wouldn't want to, you know, trust it all, you know, put it all on their shoulders. But I do think the next administration, you know, whether it's Harris or Trump, is going to have to think through what the transition plan looks like for the ISIS campaign, not just in Iraq, but also we don't really, you know, there's not a clear horizon for what happens in Syria too, where you have detention facilities with like 10,000 ISIS dudes, and you have these large refugee camps essentially with a lot of ISIS family members. And there's just a lot of stuff that still has to be done to kind of work ourselves out of that job.
Yeah, some really harrowing reporting, I think, by the New Yorker a few months back about those refugee camps and people who are just trapped in this horrible purgatory with, you know, no credible accusations against them, no way to get out, no place to go. Really, really awful. I did want to just sort of hop from war zone to war zone, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Because I imagine another, you know, issue country, issue set that you spent an enormous amount of time on was the war in Ukraine, especially when you were at the Pentagon. Recently, though, you know, the war has just been kind of steady state, awful, but seemingly frozen. I mean, some notable recent developments were just recently Zelensky reshuffled his cabinet. A few weeks back, there was that surprise Ukrainian incursion into Russian territory. Now it seems like Ukrainian troops are struggling to hold that territory. On Monday night, Ukraine launched a major drone attack into the Moscow region. It reportedly killed one person. It generally caused chaos, shut down the airport for several hours. The Ukrainian military said they launched 46 drones, 38 of which were intercepted. I assume that means the rest hit targets. This was according to CNN. And then on Tuesday, I saw Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, accused Iran of providing Russia with short-range ballistic missiles and said the U.S. would respond with more sanctions. So just, you know, we're constantly hearing about new ways that the Iranians are replenishing their stockpiles from Iran, from North Korea, from other bad actors. Last thing on this, I mean, on social media, you're now seeing these clips of Ukraine's so-called dragon drones, which are drones that spray something called thermite that burns so hot it can melt through metal, which is pretty much, you know, the scariest thing imaginable. So just a constant, you know, bruising war, massive casualties, ever-evolving and more awful sets of technologies. So with that set up, Colin, kind of in the simplest terms, you know, like 2.5 years into this war, do you feel like one side has momentum militarily?
Yeah, I think, Tommy, your setup illustrates that there's a lot going on, but in some ways, not a lot is happening in the sense that the fundamentals of the conflict have not shifted by any of the events that you enumerated. So, look, I think the Ukrainians went into Kursk to surprise the Russians, surprised us by all accounts as well, to change the narrative that they could actually generate some momentum and show that the Russians were vulnerable. I think they probably tried to bite off a piece of Russia, maybe to serve as a bargaining chip later down the road if there's negotiations to, you know, whether it's about prisoner swaps or about territorial exchanges. But I also think they were hoping that in kind of holding parts of Russia at risk, it would force the Russian army to divert some of the forces that were putting pressure on Ukraine in the east to defend the homeland. That has not happened. So what you have essentially seen is the Ukrainians do control, you know, hundreds of kilometers of Russian territory. Putin has not kind of taken the bait. They've redeployed some troops, but not the troops that are really pushing on the offensive in the east. So both sides are essentially making incremental territorial gains, but there is nothing in the fundamental dynamics that changes the reality that I don't think either side is capable of sweeping over large chunks of territory. Mm-hmm. So the good news is I don't think the Ukrainians are about to collapse and that Russia is about to take Ukraine. So that's good. The bad news is it's going to be very difficult for the Ukrainians to take back, you know, large amounts of territory that they have lost to the Russians to date. And so as a result, because there's essentially, it's not really a stalemate, but there's a degree of, you know, just horrible attrition for minimal gain on the front lines, you're seeing both sides coming over the top. So you're seeing the Russians bombard Ukrainian cities. We've seen some of the largest missile attacks on Ukraine in the entire war in the past several weeks. I think that's kind of how Putin is reacting to the Kursk. And then the Ukrainians are also coming over the top. And it's not just that they're coming over the top, but they are trying to make Russians feel the type of vulnerability that Ukrainians have felt since 2022 by holding Russian critical infrastructure at risk. And so I think where this is headed, you know, it's anybody's guess. And I obviously the outcome of the U.S. election will matter to some degree. But I do think that at some point, I think it's likely next year, the two sides will sit down and start to talk, whether they're able to come to a resolution or not. I don't know. But I think just that there's some physics problem in the war that isn't, I don't think, going to be overcome in the near term.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I mean, it does feel like the elephant in the room is the U.S. election and what Donald Trump might do versus Kamala Harris. But in the interim, I mean, the Ukrainians are constantly pushing for more weapon systems and more flexibility. That has been true all along. You know, you'll often hear, you know, background sources from in the Ukrainians military complaining that President Biden has moved too slowly on, you know, the F-16s, for example, but then gets to yes. And then the biggest source of frustration at the moment seems to be that the Ukrainian military wants permission to use U.S. weapons to strike targets inside Russia, but they basically aren't allowed to do that with some limited exceptions along the border. President Biden has talked about the risk of escalation with Russia, which is very understandable given their nuclear arsenal. Could you just take us inside some of these debates and help us understand how you guys thought about escalation risk and the rules of engagement and weapon systems?
Sure. I mean, first, it's worth keeping in mind that, you know, really Ukraine is the first conflict since the end of the Cold War where we had to relearn some of the lessons and boundaries from the Cold War experience. You know, the United States and the Soviet Union took enormous pains not to directly confront each other. They helped the North Vietnamese against us in Vietnam. We helped the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. We supported different parties in places like Angola and Nicaragua and elsewhere. It was all done very indirectly and self-consciously to manage the possibility that one of these wars could mushroom into literal mushroom clouds of World War III. So Ukraine was, you know, we've been relearning some of those lessons. And I think this is my own view, but I think that our national interests with Ukrainians, like if you did the Venn diagram, they overlap probably like 90%, maybe even 95%. But there's a sliver of difference. And the biggest difference is that the Ukrainians are fighting an existential struggle. This is literally a struggle for their country. And so they just weight the escalation issues differently because for them, they're already all in. And what else can the Russians do to them? Whereas I think, you know, President Biden, and I think any reasonable president of the United States, has a special obligation, not just to the United States, but to the world, to weigh some non-trivial risk of escalation with another major nuclear power, because it could lead to the end of the human race for all time.
Yeah.
So I don't have a lot of, you know, I think sometimes the critics who just say, you're too weak and you're too scared and it was always a bluff. And how do they know? They have no idea.
Right.
And okay, maybe the risk wasn't 30%. Maybe the risk was only 3% of a global nuclear war. Like, these are serious decisions that the president of the United States has to take into account. So look, I think we have incrementally provided the Ukrainians more ability just to hit Russian forces. To the degree that those forces are inside Russia proper or directly supporting the front lines, there's been some loosening of restrictions on U.S. weapon systems. But I think as Secretary Austin said this week, like, you know, the other part of this story is that everything is supposed to be a game changer, right? Like, you provide them Abrams tanks, it changes the game. You provide them F-16s, it changes the game. You provide them these ATACMS long-range missiles, it changes the game. You provide, you know, this, that, nothing is going to change the game in and of itself. And so if you're the president, you have to weigh whatever the assessment is of escalation risk versus the reality that no one weapon system or slight change is going to completely mean Ukrainian victory.
I think that's such an important point, because when you give them the ATACMS missiles or long-range weapons, they adjust. There was this big fight over whether the U.S. should give Ukraine Abrams tanks, and then I read that they were pulled off the battlefield because they were deemed to be ineffective or basically sitting ducks near the front lines. So, you know, there's no panacea here. I think it's an important thing to remember. And sometimes the demand for the weapon systems gets reported, and when it's not useful, you don't really read about that.
Well, I mean, look, I remember, when I was the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, I had to sign off on every single security assistance package that went up to the Secretary of Defense and then over to the State Department and the President. And I think I oversaw $43 billion of security assistance to Ukraine.
That's a lot.
So that's real money. And, you know, I was oftentimes asked, like, why aren't you, you know, giving them F-16s and why doesn't that happen faster? And I would say, look, to give them brand new F-16s would essentially consume like a third of the money that we had to provide them with it. And by the way, these weapons platforms are super sophisticated. It takes a couple of years to train pilots. And like, well, you have to make decisions about what are you prioritizing when. Now, We'll have to see what happened, but we did recently see one of the F-16s that was transferred by the Europeans crashed very early on.
Saw that.
And there's an investigation about how related that may or may not be to pilot training. And the reality is that when you rush some of these things, it may not have the effect either. So sometimes, you know, a lot of times when we would say this from the Pentagon, that Abrams tanks are really hard to maintain. And guess what? Lloyd Austin like used to drive these things around the desert, so he knows what he's talking about. Or the F-16s take a long time to train on. People would say, dismiss those concerns and just say, why do you hate freedom?
Right.
You know, it's like, that was never what it was about.
No, man. Our political debate is very, very smart. Last question for you on Ukraine. There is this allegation that I see often from the far left and the far right, often on Twitter. It's that Ukraine and Russia were very close to signing a peace deal in March of 2022, but that Boris Johnson, then the prime minister of the UK, was dispatched to Kyiv, some say by Biden himself, to scuttle that deal. And I just saw a clip of a former top State Department official named Toria Nuland, who was asked about this theory. She said basically the U.S. kind of read the terms of the agreement that Putin had put forward. They found somewhere in an annex that it had these severe limitations on what weapons systems Ukraine could have going forward, but there were no such limits on the Russian military. And I guess the concern was that leaves Ukraine vulnerable in perpetuity for another invasion. That comment by Toria was kind of taken by some as essentially confirmation that the U.S. had in part scuttled a peace deal a few months into the war. What's the truth here?
Yeah, well, look, the reality is that, you know, folks at the White House and the State Department would know more about the details. I'll just say from my perch at the Pentagon and in these interagency meetings, I never saw a serious deal on the table. That is one that would reliably and sustainably end the conflict. And yeah, the two sides were talking. But, you know, on the other hand, the Ukrainians were looking to build some momentum to get more territory back. The Russians weren't going to give their territory back. And the Russians speak out of both sides of their mouths on these things. So, you know, I can't comment on the specific annexes or details that Toria spoke to, but I think separate from like whatever the particular detail is, I just think more macro, they were not that close. Mm-hmm. And I certainly do not recall any high-level meetings, and I think I was pretty much in all of them, where the president of the United States said, you know what we should do? We should put Boris Johnson on the plane and get him to kill this deal because we don't want the war to end. Like, that's not how these conversations went down.
First of all people, Boris Johnson would not be my messenger on anything except for, you know, how to get away with get away for a little while with raging during a COVID lockdown. But yeah, I mean, I think the sort of gist is that for some reason the U.S. wanted the war to continue, maybe because they were happy that Russian forces were getting chewed up. But it sounds like you'd say that's ridiculous.
No, I mean, I think the position, you know, I think a lot of times what the U.S. government says something, they actually mean it. So, I mean, in this situation, like, we don't want the war or the peace more or less than the Ukrainians. I mean, I at the end of the day, we're not going to tell the Ukrainians what to do. It was their territory that was invaded. We can give them advice about what we think they need. And obviously, we'll make our own calculations about what we provide and under what terms and all of that. But at the end of the day, you know, we've never been in a posture where we were going to twist their arm to sign a bad deal, nor were we telling them to hold back because, you know, we didn't want a peace agreement. I will tell you, in the fall of 2022, what we were mostly focused on was the possibility that the Russians could actually non-linearly escalate to use battlefield nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And so there was no sense that, like, wow, we really want this war to keep going. Like, that was like maximum period of danger was in the fall of 2022. I mean, you remember the president of the United States saying that we were the closest to Armageddon since the Cuban Missile Crisis. So does that sound like somebody who's like, so you know what, we really want this war to keep going? Like, it's not plausible.
I have never understood this theory or the suggestion that it was somehow good for Biden to keep the war going. It strikes me as ridiculous, but I thought I'd ask. Switching to Afghanistan. So we're recording this again a couple hours before the debate tonight between the vice president and Donald Trump. We don't know what was discussed because it hasn't happened yet. But in the days leading up to this debate, it seemed clear that Trump and Republicans in Congress want to talk about the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. Mike McCaul, the chair of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, released a 354-page report that says the Biden administration had, quote, the information and the opportunity to take the necessary steps to plan for the inevitable collapse of the Afghan government and safely evacuate people, but that they, quote, picked optics over security. That's what this Republican report says, which led to, you know, the horrible images we saw in those final weeks in August, and then the death of 13 service members at the Abbey Gate, and lots of military equipment being left behind, which seems like that's the thing Trump cares about most. According to Politico, Vice President Harris was mentioned only twice in a preliminary report that McCall released in 2022, but the final report names her 251 times. I'm curious what happened between now and then, Colin. What is your takeaway to kind of like the main thrust of this report to the extent that you've had time to read it?
Sure. Look, I mean, clearly the timing and the fact that they hyphenated everything so that it's Biden-Harris, where, mm-hmm. you know, they just like found, you know, find, replace.
Control
every time
F,
it said
yeah.
Biden, they just, yeah. So, I mean, that part is transparent. The reality is that whether you think it's a good idea that we left Afghanistan or not, you know, this, the president owned that decision. The president's the commander in chief. He had very strong feelings about Afghanistan. Those feelings long predate the Biden-Harris administration to, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. back when you and I were in the White
Absolutely,
House together.
Yeah.
And you know how what he felt about Afghanistan then. So I think I wouldn't make too much about kind of the vice president's role in this. I think that's just the Republican Party trying to, you know, associate her with something they think they can use politically.
Well, I mean, presumably she was in like National Security Council meetings or principals committee meetings. But I mean, I guess you were there. I mean, was she someone that had strong views on Afghanistan policy or withdrawal? I absolutely agree, and it jives with my experience, that Joe Biden had deeply personal and strongly felt views on the need to end this war, period, paragraph. But I'm just curious what you make of her role.
Look, I first of all, I should, you know, the caveat being I didn't get confirmed in my job until the end of April, so I wasn't there for the deliberations about the withdrawal itself.
True,
I can only
right,
speak
right.
going forward. Look, I think she was in, you know, she's in the Oval Office. She's in the Situation Room for issues related to all sorts of national security issues. I did not get the sense she was the driving force behind these policies one way or the other, in large part on Afghanistan, because the president had full ownership over these decisions. I do think, look, people can agree or disagree about whether we ultimately should have left Afghanistan or whether we should have left under conditions that were more favorable, if those could even be achieved. But I do think it's important to keep in mind two things that the Republicans don't like to talk about. The first is the die was essentially cast when Trump cut the deal with the Taliban a year before
right.
Joe Biden walked into the Oval Office. They cut that deal, the Doha agreement with the Taliban, behind the backs of the Afghan government, completely delegitimizing the Afghan government. And then they proceeded to withdraw most of our forces from Afghanistan, leaving only a very small contingent of a few thousand there, in a manner that completely reduced our visibility on the types of deals the Taliban was clearly cutting at the local level, which is what they enabled them to sweep through Afghanistan mm-hmm. A year later. So, and let's also keep in mind, like, Trump basically directed the Pentagon to withdraw from Afghanistan around Christmas time with zero planning.
Right.
And it was essentially stonewalling by the Pentagon that prevented that from happening. So this notion that, like, if Trump would have been president, it would all been better. Like, that's just counterfactual.
Nonsense.
He cut the deal
yeah.
that set this up, and then he tried to get the Pentagon to leave with zero planning. And I will tell you, as someone who worked on the transition team between Trump and Biden, I should call it the non-transition team, since the Trump team was so non-cooperative, they had no plans. And whatever information they did have, they were told to hide the ball. So we come in at the beginning of 2021 with two things, a timeline, but no plan.
Wow. Yeah.
So what the president asked was, he believed that we could buy ourselves an interval into the fall. The deadline for the withdrawal was May, but we could buy ourselves an interval into the fall. But that if we pushed it too much further or completely reopened, two things would happen. One, the Taliban, which had not been attacking U.S. forces, would start attacking us again, which means we would be back at war. He didn't want us to be back at war, and neither did the majority of the American public. And then second, what he believed was we weren't winning in Afghanistan, even with, you know, a few thousand troops there. In fact, if you ask the intelligence community, when we had 2,500 troops there, when we had 8,000 troops there, when we had 25,000 or 100,000. Were we winning? The intelligence community would say, no, it's an eroding stalemate. Hmm. And an eroding stalemate means you are losing slowly.
Right.
And, you know, Obama didn't want to keep a bunch of troops in Afghanistan. Trump didn't want to keep a bunch of troops in Afghanistan. But every time the situation got bad and we were losing, what happened? Obama surged and Trump surged. So the other thing that Biden didn't want to do is to leave to the next president a situation where inevitably things were going to get worse again. And the military would come to a future president and say, we got to put more people into Afghanistan at a time when, like, you know, there are grandfathers and grandkids serving together in Afghanistan. Like, it's so I think the rapidity of the collapse, which was not predicted by the intelligence community, they told the president a year or two. And there was an anticipation that as things got worse, there would be a negotiation between the Afghan government and the Taliban. So they told him that it would be about a year or two after the complete withdrawal. Then they said, maybe it's a year. Then they said, it could be 6 months. Then they said, maybe it's a few months. And then it's a few weeks or a few days. But of course, they were saying that as we got closer and closer to it happening. But I never saw an assessment by the intelligence community that said that the Afghan government and the security forces would completely collapse prior to the end of the withdrawal, and yet that's what's happened. And so then the question is, did we do enough to plan for the worst case contingency? And I'll just speak from the Pentagon's perspective. We did enormous amounts of planning about how to execute a very large scale evacuation from Afghanistan. And we not only did the planning, we positioned forces in the Middle East for that eventuality. And as harrowing and as chaotic as the final days in Afghanistan were, and they were the worst days of my professional life in terms of like how hard and horrible things were, there was also a degree of pride that I had in what our military was able to accomplish. Just think about this. We surged 5,000 troops in a couple of days into now hostile terrain to seize an airport that was now under enemy control, secured the airport to the best of our ability, given that we no longer owned any of the rest of the country, and proceeded to get more than 125,000 human beings safely out of that country in about 2 weeks. That has never happened in the history of the world. No other power in the history of the world would be capable of doing what our military did. China won't be capable of doing it for 50 years, if ever. And I think, you know, as a Pentagon official, just watching in awe about what our military did, I know how much hard work went into making that happen, as terrible as the events were. The last point I'll make. Sorry, I don't have strong feelings about this.
No.
The last point I will make is the rapidity of the collapse. What it demonstrated to me was that this was going to happen whenever we left.
Yeah.
We were there for 20 years and it was a house of cards that collapsed like that. We could have been there for another 20 years. And the day after we left, the same thing would have happened. And so the question really is, how much more American blood and treasure should we have put into this house of cards? And I think at the end of the day, as terrible as as aspects of the withdrawal were, there was never a day afterwards where I said, you know what would make all the problems we face around the world easier? If we still had tens of thousands of troops in Afghanistan. I never felt that way. And that's the big type of strategic question that you have to ask when you're thinking about these things.
Yeah, I mean, look, we could talk for a full hour about the way the Trump administration also gutted the SIV visa program, which made it much harder for the State Department to process visas for the people that had helped the U.S. military and then bring them into the United States because people like Stephen Miller don't want brown people coming into the country. We could talk for an hour about the failure over the course of 20 years to deal with corruption or to create government structures that were viewed as legitimate by the Afghan people. We could talk about the fact that there is more, you know, scrutiny from Mike McCall and Republicans of ending a war than there was of 20 years of failed policy. So I as hard and awful as those last weeks were, and as critical as I was at times and as others were at times, I also supported ending the war, knowing that it was going to be hard, I think, in any circumstance, like you just said.
Yeah. I mean, I will second all of that.
Hi, I'm Alex Wagner. I do not need to tell you that being an American right now is a wild ride. But as a longtime journalist, I am not interested in the noise or the fear mongering. I'm interested in the stories at the heart of the headlines. That is why every week on my show, Runaway Country, I'm joined by folks in the middle of the crossfire. From disillusioned MAHA moms to newly fired immigration judges to Epstein victims themselves, to understand what it means to live through this political chaos as an actual human being. And now I'm excited to tell you that Runaway Country is available ad-free to Friends of the Pod subscribers. Friends of the Pod is the subscription that supports the work Crooked does as an independent media company and gives you a ton of great bonus and ad-free content. With the midterms approaching, you are going to need more content to keep you sane. And now you can find Runaway Country right there. Subscribe now at crooked.com/friends.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across six southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th, watch Long Play Series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, well, let's talk to another intractable problem, because last week we had some just awful news out of Nigeria, where an extremist group reportedly connected with ISIS and maybe a splinter of Boko Haram massacred 170 people in a village in the northeastern part of Nigeria. And, you know, over the past decade, countries in the Sahel region have dealt with a very serious threat from these Islamic extremist groups. And then more recently, efforts to combat them have been hobbled by coups and political instability in countries like Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, et cetera, places like Mali, where we had, you know, bases, drone bases, serious troop installation, et cetera. Often those coups led to the U.S. or the French having their counterterrorism forces pushed out, while the Wagner Group, this Russian mercenary force that we used to talk about often until Putin took out the head of it, Prigozhin, the Wagner Group would get welcomed in. And so, you know, Colin, I know I'm like at the risk of asking you to literally draw with a broad brush across the continent of Africa. I'm just wondering how worried you are about the growing threat from Boko Haram, you know, Al-Qaeda offshoots, ISIS offshoots in the Sahel, and how much you think the political instability that we've seen there has impacted the ability of the US, the French, and others to mitigate that risk.
Well, I mean, I think your lead-in captured a lot of the fundamental dynamics. So, yes, I mean, this is a region, the Sahel, kind of a band across the you know, upper middle part of Africa, that has experienced instability and fragile states for a long time. So, you know, you can go back decades, and you're talking about problems with corruption, weak institutions, food insecurity. That made increasingly worse over time due to climate change, ethnic conflict, resource conflict. So I think the way that that's manifested in recent years is kind of in three directions. One is that you've seen this kind of belt of coups. You've had coups in Mali, you've had coups in Burkina Faso and Chad and Niger. And that has also triggered or been a tipping point for the withdrawal of French counterterrorism forces, who have, you know, France has their own baggage in the region because of their colonial history. It's also complicated the ability of UN peacekeepers and other multinational forces to operate to try to stabilize any of those places. It's made life tougher for us and our counterterrorism forces to kind of, how do you maintain some presence in places where there have been coups? It's very difficult. And we don't have that big of a presence to begin with. And that all of this has essentially created freedom of action for the two bad actors that you talk about. One are kind of jihadist groups that are either associated with the Islamic State or with Al-Qaeda. And we saw examples of that in the Boko Haram story that you mentioned. But you've also seen openings for Wagner mercenaries to come in and essentially take over security roles that the French no longer serve, in a way that doesn't hold governments accountable for human rights at all. And the result has been not to really weaken the jihadists, but to create kind of gross human rights violations against civilians in a bunch of these places. And then meanwhile, you also have this layer of great power competition and the fact that China is particularly interested in deepening relationships with coastal West Africa to establish bases and facilities to project power into the Atlantic in ways that are quite concerning for the United States. So that's not great. And the conditions are certainly worsening. So, you know, to the question, how much do I ask? I worry about it. I worry about it. I think one thing, though, is that not all jihadist groups are the same, in the sense that not all of, I mean, I don't like any of them, and they're terrible threats to local populations. But some of the groups prioritize the so-called near enemy, and others prioritize the far enemy, the far enemy being the United States.
Right.
And for the most part, these groups in the Sahel are local insurgents and militia groups that are focused mostly on local territory, local criminality, destabilizing local regimes. That does not mean that they couldn't metastasize at some point into groups that more directly threaten the U.S. homeland. And I know that our intelligence community watches that like a hawk. But I would not rank these groups at the top of that list currently. I would be more worried about groups in Somalia or Yemen or Syria, a handful of other places. Maybe zoom out for just a second, Tommy, sure. in the sense that I do think that in general, we have to start thinking about Africa differently. And obviously this particular story makes us think about Africa in the way we've thought about it for a long time, which is essentially it's a continent full of failed and fragile states, humanitarian disasters, terrorism. Like, we think through that narrow lens and
the securitized relationship. Yeah, yeah.
100%. It is also rapidly emerging as, you know, one of the most populous places in the world. It's got the most demographic dynamism in the world at a time when populations are shrinking in Europe and in much of Asia, to include in China. And there's a lot of economic dynamism, too. And so that means there's enormous energy, people energy, and dynamism in the region that I think the United States has to figure out a way to engage. That instead of thinking just about counterterrorism and seeing everything through that lens, we really have to focus on inclusive development, on engaging young people and unlocking creativity and entrepreneurism across Africa. By the way, that can be good for American businesses and other things too. Like, this isn't charity, right? But really thinking about Africa as a place for strategic opportunity. And in doing that, we can also generate more resources to address some of these endemic problems. And we can compete with Russia and China. So I think instead of kind of starting with the security stuff and then gradually working our way to the other issues, I would encourage us kind of intellectually to try to flip the switch and think about it more as an opportunity. And I think this is actually one of the things that Vice President Harris has led on in the Biden-Harris administration, is really trying to think about Africa differently.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, I think that obviously it's worrisome when, you know, you have these counterterrorism platforms and they get driven out and you think, what's the impact of that? But I do think, okay, since 9/11, has the threat from, you know, Islamic extremist groups and Al-Qaeda and ISIS, has it gotten... is it greater or smaller? And I think, like, if we're not feeling like our strategies are successful in Africa, an approach that is more people focused, more economic focused, like you discussed, maybe is a better path than just blowing stuff up everywhere in perpetuity. Final place I wanted to talk with you about is just the situation in Israel, Gaza, the occupied territories. Last week, an American woman named Aishinor Agee was shot and killed at a protest in the West Bank. Local media and witnesses said she was shot in the head by an IDF sniper. Now the IDF seems to have essentially confirmed that they were responsible, although I think they're suggesting that the shooting was accidental, even if that description of it doesn't necessarily make sense with the facts as we know it. She was a recent graduate of the University of Washington. She was in the West Bank with the International Solidarity Movement, a pro-Palestinian group. On Tuesday, Secretary of State Tony Blinken called for, quote, fundamental changes to the way Israeli security forces operate in the West Bank. Here's a clip from Tony's remarks.
I think what we saw this investigation is it seems to show what eyewitnesses have said and made clear, that her killing was both unprovoked and unjustified. No one should be shot and killed for attending a protest. No one should have to put their life at risk just for freely expressing their views. In our judgment, Israeli security forces need to make some fundamental changes in the way that they operate in the West Bank, including changes to their rules of engagement.
So that's one of a series of worrisome incidents in the West Bank recently that includes, three Israelis were shot recently, major military raids, sort of the list goes on. And then in Gaza, at least 19 people have died and dozens were wounded after an Israeli strike on a humanitarian zone in southern Gaza. A witness told CBS News that 20 to 40 tents were destroyed. The IDF said it was going after some Hamas officials. But in Gaza, just steady state awful. And, Colin, we're 11 months into this war. It seems like hope for a ceasefire and hostage release deal is starting to fade. Axios reported that the U.S. now questions whether Hamas would ever agree to a deal after their brutal execution of 6 hostages and demands that Israel release more Palestinian prisoners. They seem to be upping their demands in these talks. Meanwhile, a lot of Israelis blame Netanyahu for scuttling a deal after he introduced some 11th hour demands, including that Israel retain military control of the buffer region between Gaza and Egypt, which is called the Philadelphia Corridor. Here's another quick clip of Netanyahu explaining his thinking.
We set, as far as Gaza is concerned, 3 war goals. The first war goal was to destroy Hamas's military and governing capabilities. The second was to free our hostages. And the third was to ensure that Gaza never again poses a threat to Israel. And all 3 of those goals, all 3 of them, go through Israel's control of the Philadelphia corridor. And it's obvious why. You want to destroy Hamas's military and governing capabilities, you can't let Hamas rearm. It's obvious. So you have to control the corridor. You can't let them have, by the way, it's not only to prevent them from terrorizing us, attacking us, it's also to prevent Hamas or any other terrorist organization from terrorizing the people of Gaza. Gaza cannot have a future. If Gaza remains porous and you can enable rearmament of terrorists through the Philadelphia corridor.
So, Colin, sorry for the long windup there. I mean, we know that Netanyahu's national security team doesn't necessarily agree with him about the necessity of controlling the Philadelphia corridor. They want a hostage and ceasefire deal. But I don't know, what did you make of that argument that, if you have this porous border, if you have these smuggling tunnels, that, that will allow Hamas just to rearm?
Well, look, you don't have to take my word for it. I mean, the Minister of Defense, as you mentioned, Gallant, is skeptical of this argument, and the leaders of Mossad and Shin Bet, who have been in charge of negotiating the hostage deal, have been pretty critical of, basically accusing the Prime Minister's office of moving the goalposts on the negotiations by adding the Philadelphia corridor in. I think U.S. negotiators believe that this can be negotiated in the sense that there can be some solution that doesn't probably achieve the prime minister's maximalist ambitions, but nevertheless improves the ability to monitor and control the border, but doesn't give the sense that there's an enduring IDF presence along the border between Gaza and Egypt in a way that I think just is a non-starter. I think, though, that what this speaks to is that, and I think what this is why there's growing skepticism is, on the one hand, there's this question about, is there any deal that Hamas would say yes to? Mm-hmm. Because if you figure that the hostages are their only leverage, are they ever willing to give them up? And I think that's a valid question. But on the other hand, I also think that, Prime Minister Netanyahu has let Hamas off the hook, because the narrative now is that there was basically a deal that the Israelis agreed to and that Hamas basically agreed to. And then at the last minute, the Israelis changed the terms at the request of the prime minister. And this generated complaints, by the way, from the Ministry of Defense and the Israeli Defense Forces and Mossad and from Shin Bet. And I know created a lot of frustration in Washington as well. And I think I think that's an indication that there, and certainly among the protesters, who some of whom blame the failure to cut that deal for the death of the 6 Israeli hostages. Now, obviously, the moral culpability for that rests first and foremost with Hamas, who murdered these people. But Had you had a deal in place prior to it happening, at least some of these folks might still be alive and free. So this is a very raw emotional issue for the for the Israeli people. So it's just horrible. And honestly, I think because the political dynamics are such that it's not clear what leverage points could get Hamas to yes. But also on the Israeli side, it's not clear to me that Prime Minister Netanyahu is willing to cut a deal that will collapse his government. And pretty much any deal that gives provides any concessions or accommodation on anything. And remember, he set the goal so high and almost impossibly maximalist that anything that is short of that, I think he's worried that Smotrich and Ben-Gavir will bolt from his coalition. And as a result, the government will collapse. And he's prioritizing that above other things in some analysts' view. But it does speak to, and you mentioned the West Bank at the beginning, it does speak to a broader dynamic, which is even before October 7th, settlers in the West Bank were acting in, with a degree of impunity we had not seen in recent years and engaging in escalating levels of violence. And I remember getting reports from the U.S. security coordinator in Israel, who's a U.S. general, noting that settler violence was going up and up and up and up. And you would get this spiral where there would be violence by either Palestinian militants or settlers that would set off kind of this action-reaction spiral. And one of the most troubling things was not just the violence was happening, but increasingly it looked like the IDF was letting it happen, that they were siding with the settlers and just kind of standing aside. And so you've just seen, and that's obviously all gotten worse given the raw emotions that surface after October 7th and the nature of the current Israeli government. And so I think there is just this sense that things in the West Bank are starting to spin out of control in a way that is not ultimately going to make either Israelis or Palestinians more secure. And what at the root, what both of these challenges have is that there are real political challenges that have to be sorted through, you know, obviously in Gaza on the Hamas side, but in Israel on the Israeli side as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of like the last question I wanted to ask you, which is, you know, you mentioned that Netanyahu has this maximalist goal, which is to defeat Hamas, crush Hamas, basically make it, render it no longer to exist. You worked at the Pentagon with the best military planners on the planet, backed by the most powerful military in the world, the biggest, the most sophisticated, the most expensive. And your job was to go into rooms with, you know, the Joint Chiefs of Staff and try to figure out military plans to defeat groups like Hamas. Do you think that that is an achievable mission to defeat them militarily, absent the political accommodations that you mentioned before?
No. And honestly, we learned that the hard way in our own experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think that not a lot of people remember, but one of the early, even as he was embracing Israel and its need for security after October 7th, one of the things that President Biden said right away was, don't repeat the mistakes we made after 9/11.
Right. Yeah.
And then they did. So I think at the end of the day, and look, you don't have to believe me or you. I mean, this is what senior commanders in the IDF are saying. This is what Minister Gallant is saying. This is what the Mossad and Shin Bet guys are saying. You cannot destroy Hamas as a movement and an idea militarily. You can't. So you have to set a different goal, which is the degradation of Hamas such that October 7th doesn't happen again. And people can probably debate where that threshold is. I think the folks I speak with in the U.S. government believe that threshold has been achieved. Obviously, there are people in Israel who may have a different view. So if your achievable military objective has been met, then the question is, what makes Israel safer over the long term? And I don't think it makes Israel safer for Gaza to be completely destroyed, ungovernable, never rebuilt. It will just be a hotbed for regenerating Hamas or something else that's even worse, because that's where we've seen everywhere else in the world. There has to be reconstruction. There has to be humanitarian assistance. There has to be a political horizon for a two-state outcome, even if it won't materialize overnight. And there has to be an embrace of that entire ecosystem by the international community, not just the United States and our friends in Europe and elsewhere, but by moderate states in the region as well. We kind of know what the broad strokes look like. The challenge, Tommy, is that the politics on both sides of this conflict make it really hard to see how we get there anytime soon.
Yeah, need the political will. Colin, thank you so much. That was such a fascinating just tour around the globe. I am so grateful for you doing the show. And, you know, let's go watch this debate. Let's go feel anxious for a few hours.
Yeah. Yeah, sounds great. All
right. Thanks,
thanks
again.
Tommy. Thanks for having me. Yeah.
Appreciate it. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. But before we do, I just want to make sure you know about a brand new Crooked show called Empire City. It's from Wondery, Crooked Media, and Push Black. It just premiered. It is called Empire City, the Untold Origin Story of the NYPD. It is a truly, truly excellent show. We've been working on this show for years. Empire City unearthed the shocking and largely hidden history of one of the world's largest police forces. It's hosted by a Peabody Award winner. That's all you need to know. His name is Chenjerai Kumanyika. He is an incredibly smart historian, journalist who digs into the early days of the New York City Police Department. The show actually starts in the 1930s before the NYPD came into existence. They talk about how police were actually kidnapping free black people and selling them into slavery. The first two episodes are out now. Check out Empire City wherever you get your podcasts. And you can listen early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app on Apple Podcasts. But trust me, download Empire City, subscribe. You will love this show. Also, last night's presidential debate, which I haven't seen yet, reminded me of the stakes of this election year. You know, we got to figure out which of these people is going to get the nuclear codes. And so that's where you guys come in. So we set this ambitious goal of getting 75,000 signups for Vote Save America's Organize or Else volunteer drive. We're at 62,000. We want to get to 75,000 by National Voter Registration Day on September 17th. So you can help by going to votesaveamerica.com/2024. And in less than 5 minutes, you can take meaningful actions to help Democrats win up and down the ballot. Again, votesaveamerica.com/2024. This message has been paid for by Vote Save America. You can learn more at votesaveamerica.com. And this ad has not been authorized by any candidate or candidates committee.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across six southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th. Watch Long Play series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across six southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th. Watch Long Play series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Joining me today is Vera Bergen-Gruen. She is an excellent reporter for Time Magazine, who covers foreign policy, national security, right-wing despots across South and Central America. Really some of the best stuff I've read recently. So thank you so much for joining the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I was like half kidding there. I mean, you very recently interviewed some of the most controversial and frankly interesting leaders in Central and South America. And I'm very excited to talk with you about those two and those conversations and what it tells us about kind of the political winds around the world at this moment and the appeal of right-wing populism in particular. So let's just start in Argentina. With a leader named Javier Milei. We've talked about him on this show before. For those who don't remember, he's an economist, often described as an anarcho-capitalist. He's a TV personality who ran for president threatening to blow the economy up, or promising to, rather. He used to bring a chainsaw to events because he said he was going to use it on the government. There were rumors that he had hired mediums to talk to the dead, including some of his own pets. He has said that some of his dogs are his closest advisors. I'm now just stealing all the fun color from your reporting, so I'm going to shut up. But can you just tell us about Milei and how a guy who, frankly, at times sounds and looks a little crazy, won the presidency with, I think, 56% of the vote?
Yeah. So, you know, just from context, I'm from Uruguay, which is the country right next to Argentina. And I've been pitching stories about Argentina my whole, you know, the decade I've been in journalism, and no one's ever interested. It's been in the same economic crisis for a decade. But this really, really colorful character shows up and suddenly, you know, people can't get enough. And he, you know, he's the thing to know about Milei is he's a true ideologue. You know, you see him, he's truly, I mean, he is a character. You know, he's out there. He's got, when we put him on the Time cover, the biggest comments were really about his hair. He looks like a Wolverine meets like a Tolkien character vibe. And he, you know, he's really, really just not, you can tell he's not a politician, but he's really just, you know, an incredibly colorful character. He, like you said, he campaigned with a chainsaw. He can't seem to really control his emotions. He sobs on camera. He's, you know, he's just a very, again, just a very memorable character who came on the scene as a pundit, as an economics analyst. And I think what that really drew people to him, because he, again, he there's no filter. He, you know, we're now kind of used to pundits who become, I guess, politicians or presidents. But over there, you know, it gave him credibility. The fact that he was just kind of, he says he doesn't comb his hair because the invisible hand of the market does it for him, right? But when you meet, you know, it seems like an act. And I thought it was much of it was an act. But, you know, meeting him and meeting people around him and spending a long time reporting this profile, you know, he's just, again, like a true ideologue, an economist who came on with these ideas that sound really common sense on the surface. He's saying we're going to, you know, end government subsidies. We're going to cut governments in half. No more money for all these bloated, you know, welfare systems, which, you know, it's true Argentina does have. And we're going to get out of this economic crisis. It's going to be, you know, it's going to be very painful. And he won telling Argentines, you know, you're going to, you think it's bad now, it's going to get so much worse before it gets better. But it just, I think, tells you how desperate Argentines are. You know, I've got family there. If anyone knows Argentines, I mean, it's been more than 20 years. And before then, just really, really, really dire economic crisis for a country that is very wealthy, you know, has a lot of natural resources and feels like its destiny is not to be this way. So I think people just were really feeling like they were hitting rock bottom. And the other person running was the economy minister. And they looked at these two and said, you know what, screw it. We're going to go with this guy.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's so interesting. I mean, you kind of you answered a bit of my next question, which was, you know, Boris Johnson over in the UK would sort of like, you know, mess up his hair and go out and do this kind of like oafish, you know, routine. And it was clearly an act because this is a guy who went to some of the best schools in the country and grew up privileged, et cetera, just performing. But and I read in your piece that Milei had actually changed the law to hire his sister to become his top media advisor. I think you said a couple years earlier, she was selling cakes on Instagram and now she's the gateway to the presidency, which made me wonder, is this a performance? Is this an act? Is someone who's putting on a show that he knows kind of matches the burn it all down times? But it sounds like your impression was this guy's a true believer.
He is definitely a true believer in himself, to the extent that even, you know, he's a theorist, an economic theorist. So I think he would be willing to drag the country down even further. I mean, I don't believe this. A lot of people kind of say this just to prove his economic theories right. Right. And so I think he is a true believer in his own kind of ideologies. And he is, I mean, he's one for drama. I'm not saying it isn't an act whatsoever. I mean, a couple of months ago, I think right around the time the story came out, he booked a stadium filled it with supporters and like did a whole rock act. I'm not sure if you saw this. It kind of made every headline you ever see about Milei, almost all of them have this slant to them because it's so outlandish. He sang like, you know, 1980s Argentine rock. And so clearly he loves it. And it's not that he isn't doing that in a self-aware way, but I don't think it's an act in the sense that he is doing it because he is completely convinced it's going to help him politically. It's because he, you know, he's feeling the adulation of the public. And to be honest, one of the most interesting things is he hasn't lost a huge amount of public support, even though he's been a president for, you know, more than half a year and things haven't really improved. So I think people still are kind of willing to give him the benefit of the doubt. But that public persona he has, maybe it's, again, an indication of where Argentina's at, but it's only kind of helping him because people kind of think someone that wild must be a genius. We'll see.
Oh, God. Yeah, no, I mean, guess, you know, probably Trump gets some credit for that. They think he's so crazy, it might just work on the international stage, so he's unpredictable. But, I mean, you're right. Like, Milei promised to do all these big things. He wants to, he said he'd eliminate the central bank, slash spending, get inflation under control. The list goes on and on. But as you pointed out in your story, his party actually has very little power in the legislature, which means they can't do the big structural reforms that are probably needed to really get Argentina out of, you know, debt. I think it owes, what, $44 million or billion dollars, I think, to the IMF. And so really good politicians in a situation like that are able to blame their political opponents for obstructionism sometimes and reap a political benefit. But more often than not, if problems don't get solved, voters stay pissed off and they end up punishing the people in power. But it sounds like you think so far he's not getting punished for lingering inflation, for example.
That's what it seems at the moment. I think partly, again, people don't really have many more options. And even when you speak to people who don't support him, they're still kind of, you know, they don't have any. He's plan, you know, Z. Like there's nothing. They've tried everything else. So I think that's partly why. There's another interesting part to it, which is for the, again, as I mentioned, you know, I've been pitching Argentina stories for a very long time. It's the same crisis, but for the first time in a long time, Argentina is kind of on the international stage. They see like him meeting with Elon Musk, and Elon Musk is saying, I would love to come invest in your country. And to Argentines, that is just like crack, you know, like any public international acclaim is important. So I think that's a big part of it. I do think that a lot of people who are, you know, again, things haven't really, in some ways they've improved on a spreadsheet, but they, you know, in order to get there, it's really, you know, tanked other parts of the economy. People are still really hurting. You know, when I was in Argentina in April, I went to a public university around the time there was a big fight about funding and the students were having classes in the dark and the hallways were dark and hospitals were, you know, student hospitals were kind of operating, you know, with little generators because he had cut public funding. Pensioners are really feeling it. So people are really pissed off and there's a lot of protests. And yet at the same time, it's still kind of balanced out, I think, by not only the fact that they're willing to let him kind of feel it out and give him more time, but also because I think they're seeing a lot of international, you know, just interest and a lot of international validation of him as some kind of economic genius and seeing people on social media and on, you know, again, mainly right wing people, but just kind of saying, oh, we wish we had a Milei. We'd love to have our own Milei. That's really the stereotype of Argentines is, you know, quite an arrogant people. I can say that as a Uruguayan, but I think a lot of that is kind of helping to keep his popular support because even though they're not seeing it yet, there's a lot of public, again, global attention and they like that.
No, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, Elon Musk, I think, wants access to Argentina's lithium for batteries for Teslas down the road. But you're right. I mean, look, Milei is on the cover of Time. I mean, I'm sure that's a fascinating thing for people in Argentina. He's speaking at CPAC. He's giving bro hugs to Donald Trump as they kind of walk on and off the stage. So, yeah, he's got this profile that you didn't necessarily get from the past leaders. But the other leader you spoke with recently is a guy named Nayib Bukele. He's the president of El Salvador. You landed, I believe, his first interview with a foreign reporter in 3 years. So congrats. That's very cool. I think big picture, what people need to understand about Bukele is he is wildly popular. He's I think, the most popular leader in the Western Hemisphere, if not the world. But he's also done some stupid things, like, in my opinion, at least, like using treasury funds to buy Bitcoin. He'd tweet about buying the dip. Probably not something one should do with the state funds. He's also done some very authoritarian things, like storming into parliament surrounded by armed members of the military, demanding that the parliament vote on bills. And there was this statistic from your story that really shocked me, which was that one in every 57 Salvadorans is now incarcerated. One in every 57 people is now incarcerated. So can you just start by telling us a bit about who Nayib Bukele is and the context in El Salvador that led to his political rise in popularity?
Yeah, that was a great summary. But, you know, again, kind of speaking of, you know, how, when's the last time that a lot of average Americans knew the name of a Central American leader? His fame, because of what he's done, as you just mentioned, far exceeds, you know, it's a country of 6 million people. And so I think the secret to that is his background as a publicist. He used to run a political ad agency. He's a millennial. He became president in 2019 when he was 37, which is pretty wild. And now he's 42. He just won a second term, and he, you know, anyone who really, you know, you can see him on the cover of Time, you can kind of follow him on social media. He is incredibly good. He's very, very slick. He's very good at projecting a certain thing on social media. He's wearing, you know, jeans and leather jackets and a backwards baseball cap. And, you know, he speaks in these like tight, like, you know, like long sleeve shirts instead of wearing a suit. And it's like a particular look and a particular irreverent kind of vibe, which really is meant to more than just be popular or seeming young and, you know, interesting domestically, is really projected outward at getting attention globally. And so he won kind of by projecting this image of a fresh start for El Salvador. You know, they had this absolutely brutal civil war. Since then, they've been just completely torn apart by these gangs. Just almost everybody in the country was just completely under the thumb of these very vicious gangs. And he comes from a very, very wealthy family. As I mentioned, he was kind of like an ad man. And he comes in and instead of, you know, subscribing to one of the two political parties, which were all tied up with either corruption or the civil war or just kind of these like old Cold War revolutionary slogans, which are very outdated, he creates his own party. Mm-hmm. He, you know, new colors, new everything, you know, Twitter challenges, TikTok. And, and he's genuinely popular. This isn't like a Putin. He's genuinely wildly, wildly popular. You know, he dared me in our interview to go find someone who had a negative opinion. And it was actually difficult. And, you know, to be fair, I was there for a week, but it is genuinely difficult. Anyone who asks Salvadorians in the U.S. is likely finding the same thing. And he, you know, like I said, just won a second term. We can discuss more all the different things he's done. But I think the most important thing, as I pointed out in my article, is, you know, it sounds cliche, but is his past as a publicist, is the fact that everything he does is, one of his friends told me, he already always sees everything like a movie reel, like a trailer. You know, he has that eye. So it's important to understand, from Bitcoin to the war on the gangs, everything he does, he's kind of image first, or, you know, results later oriented.
Yeah, I mean, I do think the Bitcoin thing is an interesting example, because he was this big vocal adopter of Bitcoin, and it wasn't just tweeting about how he was going to buy the dip and use treasury funds to purchase Bitcoins. It was about essentially trying to create this image of El Salvador as like the first country to adopt Bitcoin as legal tender. I think he talked about building a Bitcoin city that was powered by volcano energy, right? It's like
Still hasn't happened.
It's fucking nonsense. Yeah. And I don't believe, I mean, I think you reported on this, but I don't believe Bitcoin adoption is really happening in El Salvador, right?
You know, it's interesting. When I spoke with him, I expected him to kind of bluff a bit more. He straight up just kind of admitted. He said it hasn't had the adoption we hoped. You know, but it was, again, it was always pointed. I mean, his advisors openly just told me, they say they call it the great rebranding. They were saying it was a complete PR move. We needed people to think of El Salvador and us as a place of like migrants and violence. We needed them to think of something different. And so it was never really meant to be adopted, you know, to really change Salvadorian's economic situation. But he announced it at this, you know, Miami Bitcoin conference in 2021. And Salvadorians just found out about it the next day, like on Twitter or in the newspaper. Like, you know, there was no announcement for the Salvadorian public. And then they kind of had to backtrack and kind of say, okay, it's going to make remittances easier. You know, good third of the Salvadorian population lives outside the country. It's going to make certain things better for the public. Everyone got, I think, $30 in a digital wallet to spend. It was, you know, chaos from the start, but they needed to kind of at least pretend that it was really going to help El Salvador. But the way that it was really going to help El Salvador in their view, was by rebranding it and by making people think of it as a cool. I mean, I remember, I'm not sure about you, when I first heard about this, like the last country I really expected to adopt, but be the first one to adopt Bitcoin was El Salvador. It was very obvious, you know, that it was kind of for tourists, for foreigners, for him to have something to talk about that changed the narrative. And in that, I mean, if that was the goal, they have been successful. You know, it is, there's all these crypto bros all over El Salvador, you know, buying houses and investing money and making it more expensive for everyday people. But it's, it's worked in that sense. But yeah.
Yeah, the online crypto community is a bunch of suckers, and Bukele got people like Jack Dorsey and, you know, others to tweet about it. So good for him, I guess. But, you know, you're right. Like, he acts like, Bukele acts like kind of a troll. He likes to talk shit on Twitter. I think does he still call himself a dictator in his Twitter bio?
No longer. Now he is the philosopher king, quote unquote.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. That's much better.
He's moved on.
Thank God. Good for him. Way to grow up. We all have to do it eventually. But, you know, it's kind of this bro-y, obnoxious image. Was that the vibe you got in person?
You know, in person. So we I think an important thing is that we did the interview in Spanish. I'm from South America. So it was interesting. In Spanish, this happens to be with a lot of leaders, but he's slightly different because he speaks in the way that he usually speaks to Salvadorians or to other people in the region and not to his Twitter audience, where he mainly speaks in English. He tweets and TikToks, if that's a word, all the time in English. And so he code switches based on his audience. And I actually asked him about that. So, but you know, he's a very interesting guy. He's, you know, he's very slender, very well-dressed, was wearing all dark ensemble. And one of the things I find very interesting, again, he doesn't really speak to journalists. So, I could tell that for him, that was a big deal. He obviously wanted to be on the cover of Time. Even Bukele couldn't resist that. But, he doesn't really speak much to journalists, but he receives a lot of people in the same chair that I was sitting in. And if you ever watched some videos of him, it's really kind of entertaining to me. He has this very slow-moving, kind of self-assured body language, and it makes anyone sitting in front of him look really overeager. So you see Malay, you see Don Jr. was like really like jittery, super excited to meet him, you know. So he has this kind of very suave, very slow kind of, you know, you are on my turf kind of vibe. And same with, you know, with journalists, but, you know, very polite. When we were speaking, he kind of spoke in numbers, so everything he told me, he always backed it up with some data point because he said, of course, I'm going to lie. Of course, I'm going to cast everything in the best light. You can check. So he seemed very self-conscious, I think. And also, I think that, you know, again, that's why he hasn't spoken, I think, to journalists. He's, again, a fairly young leader. And I think in a different way from Malay, pretty sensitive to criticism.
Yeah. So I definitely take on board your points about his experience as sort of an ad man and image maker. It's clearly been unbelievably effective, especially to a Western audience. But I think like the broader story in El Salvador is something we've seen before, which is a country dealing with a horrific security situation and citizens who are willing to trade, at least in the short term, rights and civil liberties for security, which leads to that unbelievable arrest rate that you talked about, which is, I think, 1 in 57 people in the country in prison. In the long term, in the short term, that approach can work. In the long term, it almost always ends badly. Is there any sense that that frustration is starting to build? I mean, I can't imagine what it would be like if I myself or my son or my daughter were thrown into jail having done nothing, just getting swept up in one of these raids on quote unquote gangs that, you know, seemingly just sweep up innocent people too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think honestly what's happening in Salvador is one of the most complex situations I've had to cover recently because it is very, very difficult as an outsider to cover because, you know, truly none of us will ever understand what it was like to live under the gangs. And I know we say that a lot, but, you know, it's right. Truly no one wants to go back to that. And they are willing to sacrifice a lot to not do that. And so there's two parts to that. There's the fact that, you know, several people kind of told me, so what if Bukele made deals with the gangs, if he, you know, some money goes missing? You know, that's always been the state of our country. At least now it's kind of, you know, it has a different image to it. You know, again, like I think he has, you know, over 94% approval rating. It's, you know, and again, it's real. It's, wow. You know, this is not, you can tell. And it's something that I think, as you alluded to, you know, basically they've done away with due process. They had these massive kind of sweeps, mass arrests. You know, kids as young as 12 can now be tried as adults. They have these mass trials of 700-800 people where that's kind of where they decide their fate. They've built these absolutely massive mass prisons, which are now, you know, kind of become aspirational to many in the region because there's, you know, such an insecurity crisis.
Yeah.
But all of the things that we kind of look at and imagine, you know, if my family member had to go through that, that would be awful. So many people I spoke with who have family members in jail, including people who they know are innocent, still as a whole kind of say, kind of almost think it's a worthwhile cost. And that's a hard thing, I think, to cover from a Western or outside perspective sometimes. But, you know, it is absolutely true. And so I to answer your question, that front, how long can it hold? That's a really interesting question, because obviously they've tried this before. It's called mano dura, or iron fist. And then this thing happened in the early 2000s where they went to super mano dura, like super iron fist. And each president tried to up the other to be tough. But they never really were able to hold it for long. And the question here is, of course, Bukele changed the constitution or reinterpreted, as his advisor told me to call it.
Right.
Reinterpreted the constitution to be able to run for a second term, which most scholars and most people there know is unconstitutional. So he's you know, but people broadly supported him. The question is, what happens when he's out of office, you know? There's some rumors. Is it he's one out of many brothers? Could it be basically kind of like a dynasty that emerges? Because, you know, his previous, I think, three predecessors are all in jail or under indictment out of the country. He knows what happens. Everyone knows what happens to Central American leaders and strongmen when they get out of office. He can't be there anymore. So I think the sense I got was from most people that he's likely, he said, he told me, and this was big news in the region, that he's not going to seek a third term. He's going to be 47 when he leaves. Seems pretty unlikely to me he's going to go willingly. But again, you know, they're kind of, when you have that much support from the public and that much broad backing, and they are asking you to continue doing what you're doing, it's kind of hard to imagine they'll suddenly release a lot of these people and, you know, go back to non-emergency state. So that is a rambling answer, but it's a really, I mean, a truly fascinating thing that's happening there.
I think it's such important context. It's very easy for me to sit in, you know, Los Angeles and, you know, criticize his record on civil liberties when I didn't have to live through the violence that these people had to live through. And I think you're right about Bukele. I mean, you have to expect he'll try to cling to power unless, I don't know, maybe he'll like go work for Andreessen Horowitz or one of those crypto VCs up in Silicon Valley. I could see him fitting right in there. But just like bigger picture, I mean, I'm curious what your takeaway has been from all your reporting on the region, talking to these two, you know, leaders who are both kind of like right wing, part of the CPAC crowd. They're all friends with Don Jr. and Matt Gaetz and kind of like the worst people in American political life. But, you know, if you pressed me to like offer a takeaway, having watched elections over the past couple of years, I would think that it was voters are so mad and they are happy to punish any incumbent and reward a lot of newcomers from across the political spectrum. But it does seem like these right-wing populists have done particularly well, as, you know, sort of evidenced by these two. But I'm curious what your like takeaway has been.
Yeah, I mean, it's been really, again, not to keep harping on it, but as someone who covers the region and closely watches the region and always finds it at the very, very bottom of the list after every other continent when it comes to interest, characters like Milei and Bukele and the really extreme radical measures they're implementing are suddenly, again, they're almost household names, especially in right-wing circles. And I've spent a lot of time also covering kind of the U.S. right wing. So for me, these two things converged. And I think it's because they were both elected by people in economic or security, really dire straits, like incredibly desperate population willing to do anything. Obviously, that is not the case in the countries their fanboys live in the U.S. or in Europe. But they have a mandate to just tear everything up, and not in a Donald Trump way, like seriously, like really tear apart the government, completely change everything. And that is a fever dream for these MAGA guys. Like, it's fascinating. Like, there's this clip of Milei with I think Post-its on the wall, and he's tearing them off, just yelling, you know, all of them are names of ministries, like Ministry of Women.
Yes,
Ministry,
yes.
Have you seen it? Yeah. And he's just yelling, afuera, yes, yes. Afuera, out, out. And like that clip is just circulates in every right-wing space I'm ever in, because that is the dream of a lot of these guys. Like, and it doesn't matter that it would never work It's just the theatricality of it, and the idea of it is so appealing. And so these guys get a rock star welcome at CPAC, at all these different places. Same with Bukele. It's like, you know, of course, just lock all the gang members in jail. Like, why can't we do that? And
right.
a surprising number right. of, you know, not only national, there's now a U.S. El Salvador caucus. I'm told Matt Gaetz is scouting for a house on the Salvadorian coast. He, Bukele are bros now.
Okay.
But you know, the point being, they're basically using these countries as a foil to really show what they would love for, you know, in their mind for the U.S. to do. And they love talking about it without really much of a thought of what it's like to live through the consequences of these decisions for the citizens of these countries. But so, you know, that exactly as you said, it's kind of people wanting to go for someone new, but that's not really, you know, that's just cyclical. But I think what's happening with these two people in particular is that they are the most like dramatic, exaggerated expression of what a lot of these people would love to see in their own countries, even though, again, it would never work. Mm-hmm. And it's so colorful and it's so made for the TikTok era that, again, you go to any of these comment sections, you hear not only national, but state and local lawmakers, and they're all, you know, Bukele and Milei are constantly invoked because they like to tie themselves to these, especially Bukele, to kind of a popular guy who's doing these things. And again, mm-hmm. they don't really have to deal with the fallout or how difficult any of that would be in their own context, right?
Yeah, and a slightly, I mean, like, if you're going to look at the track record, it's going better than, say, Liz Truss, the Tory party leader, who also is trying out the CPAC circuit and, you know, probably not getting the same reception. Ugh, the Matt Gaetz of it all.
Not quite.
It's really upsetting. I'm sure he's burning up the tinder down there. But because you also cover the U.S. right wing, that gets me my last question, which is, last week, the Department of Justice unsealed this indictment accusing two employees of a Russian government-funded network called RT. It accused them for covertly funding a bunch of right-wing media personalities. For the people who spend way too much time on the internet like I do, you will be familiar with assholes like Tim Pool, Benny Johnson, Dave Rubin, Lauren Souther, and just kind of like the worst propagandists for, you know, TPUSA, or, you know, Benny Johnson used to plagiarize Tumblr and put it up on BuzzFeed, et cetera, et cetera. So those personalities got paid tons of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars, to produce content for a company called Tenet. And surprise, surprise, that content tended to align with Russia's narrative on a bunch of issues, including that Ukraine is evil, et cetera. First question, you got any of that sweet, sweet Russian cash? And then second, were you surprised by how brazen this effort was? And also maybe what a waste of money it might have been, given how infrequently these clips seem to have been viewed?
I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. I mean, about the cash, the thing that struck me, the very first thing was just, I mean, it was massive amounts of money, you know, and they're pretending, you know, I work in journalism. They're pretending that they were used by Russia, had no idea that someone was paying them $400,000, I think, dollars a month to make four videos, you know, could possibly be something sketchy or, you know, using them for their, you know, whatever, their clout. I've covered influence operations, especially Russia's, for a long time as well. And it's been interesting to see. I'm not sure if they've gotten sloppy. Again, this is actually a lot of money. So they're not, this is not them just trying to like pay like Macedonian teenagers, right, to do operate a
right.
troll farm.
Right.
It's kind of going with this. And the other thing that I just find really funny, I'm not sure, I'd be curious on your thoughts on this, is how long we spent for the last 2 years or so hyperventilating about AI and these very sophisticated algorithms that are going to cause chaos. And all they really are needed mm-hmm. to do was pay a bunch of, you know, guys who were very happy to
right.
be used. It's pretty, pretty funny how
totally.
We just keep going back to the very basics when it comes to these things. In terms of effectiveness, it is kind of curious because they could easily have probably gotten this far without paying them nearly as much money, because these are already viewpoints
yeah.
that they were happy to espouse. And, you know, I'm curious whether, you know, several of these guys have pretty large followings. I'm wondering if maybe they were ill-informed about their reach. But you know, I think ultimately the point, and this has always been Russia's kind of tactic, is less to be effective and more just to make people distrust anything they read or hear. So, you know, since 2016, every time we see someone parroting Russian talking points, even if sometimes it's just somebody's legit skepticism about the war in Ukraine or something else, immediately called a Russian plant, you're being paid by the Kremlin. And so having a bunch of guys actually come out to have been paid by the Kremlin It really helps Russia either way, right? It just makes people distrust basically any journalist, quote unquote journalist, or all these people that they hear.
Yeah, it's such an interesting debate because I think the worst thing we could do is make them seem 10 feet tall and like they're controlling our media when in reality they were paying some pathetic little goober in a beanie to make a couple of videos that no one ever watched that basically seemed to have jived with his views in the first place. Although there was one, you know, there's one clip where he is calling Ukraine evil and saying they're the greatest threat to Western security that you kind of wondered, you know, and who in the Russian intelligence services might have drafted that one up for him. But I guess time will tell. But so on the one hand, like, I think they pissed away a lot of money here. On the other hand, it did make me wonder what other influence operations we maybe haven't caught and aren't seeing and how it might impact our politics. It also reminded me of 2016, where I could be remembering this wrong, but I think there was an example of basically the Russian troll farms were spinning up both sides of the policing debate. Like they were getting Black Lives Matter groups angry and also Blue Lives Matter groups and trying to like send them to the same location in Texas somewhere and seeing if they'll like fight it out. So they're just kind of like, you know, pouring gasoline on our own internal discord in ways that, I don't know, you don't need to be an intelligence operative to do. You just need to have a Twitter account, Twitter Blue or something.
Yeah. And I think you're complete. My first thought all the time is just, this is just one, you know, and this is a very high profile one. This is a huge amount of money. It was always going to come out, but there's so much going on. And again, if you look at different regions of the world, you know, there's so much. I mean, one of the reasons it didn't really work here is because we've got like a very busy, thriving media ecosystem in the United States. So it was never, but what if, you know, you're paying someone in Latin America, as we discussed, or in a small country in Europe?
Right.
I've covered a lot of Russian efforts and Chinese efforts in Latin America. And it's just, you know, there's a vacuum and they just fill it in. Like RT Spanish is incredibly popular. I remember doing some reporting on Assange, like 2018 or so, a long time ago, and the only articles in Spanish I could find about some stuff that involved Ecuador that was actually important to the, you know, to the country was Russian-funded outlets. You know, there's where there isn't like a lot of support or money for journalism, they just kind of step in. And so I think obviously this, it was kind of cartoonish. We like to think they didn't, you know, mislead a huge amount of people. And again, this was, I'm just still stunned by the amount of money, which was, you know, I don't think great, you know, return on investment, but in I think the main thing people should just take away from this is, you know, this is obviously not the only one. This is a very brazen one, but they are, so, you know, there's just, it's all over. And especially in countries that don't, well, we're never going to find out exactly, you know, where the impact is much larger because they're kind of stepping into this vacuum, right?
Yeah, a really good way to phrase it. Just be skeptical. If you find something that so perfectly comports with your views, maybe check it twice. That's a good way to go.
Yeah, if someone has one Russian talking point, right? It's one thing. For me, it's always, yeah. I'm like, okay, that's five in a row. That's.
yeah, right. If some account that used to only tweet in Mandarin is sort of yelling at you about the 9-dash line, maybe, you know, scroll up and vet that. Vera, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you.
Can people find your work and follow you? Everyone should read your interviews with Mile and Bukele because they're just fascinating stories. But where should they be looking?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter, Vera M. Bergen. That's where all my stuff goes. And, you know, you can go to, you know, my author page on Time's website. But yeah, I obviously biased, but I think those two interviews, especially for people who don't have much of an idea of what's going on in South America, I think they kind of complement each other to really show what's going on. So
they really do. Truly excellent. Well, listen, thank you again. And I hope to talk again soon.
Thanks so much.
Thanks again to Colin. Thanks again to Vera for joining the show. Thanks again to all of you who make it to the outro each week. I love you for doing so. And Ben will be back next week. Excited to talk to him and talk to you then. If you want to get ad-free episodes, exclusive content, and more, consider joining our Friends of the Pod subscription community at crooked.com/friends. Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter for more original content, host takeovers, and other community events. Plus, find Pod Save the World on YouTube for access to full episodes, bonus content, and more. If you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping a review. Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. Our producer is Ilona Minkowski. Our associate producer is Michael Goldsmith. Our executive producers are me, Tommy Vitor, and Ben Rhodes. The show is mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick and engineered by Vasilis Fotopoulos. Audio support by Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Madeline Herringer is our head of news and programming. Matt DeGroat is our head of production. Andy Taft is our executive assistant. Thanks to our digital team, Phoebe Bradford, William Jones, Kirill Palaviv, and Molly Lobel, who upload our episodes and videos to youtube.com/podsavetheworld.
Hey, I'm Ryan Knutson, co-host of The Journal, a daily news podcast about money, business, and power. Every day on our show, we bring you the most fascinating stories from the business world, from covert corporate moves.
What Amazon was doing is they set up a very secretive shell company that people at Amazon didn't even know existed.
To the soda wars.
Dr. Pepper? Like, where did it come from? It came out of nowhere.
You'll hear it all on The Journal. Find The Journal on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, my name is Mitch Landrieu.
My name is Erin Haynes.
My name is Jennifer Palmieri, and we're hosting a new series called Long Play. The South is the new political epicenter of the country. Democrats are way on their heels in this region, but Republicans are going through their own reckoning in the South, too.
I mean, the South has always shaped American politics. We know that.
The stakes could not be higher, but to win the South, you have to understand it.
People in the South feel really misunderstood, left behind, put down on, and they want to explain that to somebody.
We're traveling across six southern states to explore the people, the issues, the assumptions that no longer hold, and what the rest of us are missing about a region that will shape the future of our politics and our country. From Left, Right, and Crooked Media, starting July 27th, watch Long Play series on YouTube at youtube.com/longplayseries or listen wherever you get your podcasts.